Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey on November 30th, 2019. This is class 26 of our 32 class study of Vipassana, Introspective Insight into Anicca, Anatta, and Dukkha. This talk in our Sangha discussion is on Ajiri Mananda Sutta. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. Our friend Tim, sitting right here, brought up something that's in the sutta, the word repulsive, and why is it there, and isn't it too strong of a word? And so some of you may have the same reaction, some of you don't. But it's important to recognize these. For one thing, to understand that words are just words. And the doctrinal words of the Buddha, even though they're from an awakened human being, are still just words. And as all words are ultimately an abstraction of what we're trying to describe, if we start analyzing them or even looking at why am I reacting to them rather than just noticing reaction, we're simply getting stuck into, we're trying to create a fabricated view of how to understand this fabrication that's causing the reaction, when it's just another word. It's just, the word repulsive following the word and, A-N-D, has no more weight than the A-N-D, than R-E-P-U-L-S-S-I-V-E. They're just a collection of letters, except we don't have a conditioned response to A-N-D, but some of us do to that other word. But it's just that, it's just a word. And it points to, in this sutta, an important overarching necessity that the Buddha teaches, that the wise know the danger and even the slightest, the word is different in different applications, but even the slightest infractions, meaning anything that isn't framed by right view, someone developing the Dhamma understands the infraction of clinging to that view, even a view that a word can somehow be repulsive, the word itself. Even if the word is repulsive, it's just a word. And it's there for a very important reason. So thank you, Tim, for initiating that discussion. We will, let me introduce today's class after we meditate. So let's meditate first. So now is the time to meditate. Now is a time to set mindfulness on the breath in the body and do jhana. Find your relaxed meditation posture, holding your back straight but not stiff. Your ears aligned with your shoulders, your nose aligned with your navel. And holding yourself softly, gently, lovingly, allow yourselves to settle into this room, settle onto your seats, settle into your bodies, and settle into your minds. Notice the sensation of breathing in your body. Become mindful of your inhalation and your exhalation, your in-breath and your out-breath. While remaining mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath, notice that feelings arise and thoughts are flowing. We are sensitive and conscious beings. Feelings arise and thoughts flow. The purpose of meditation is to increase concentration and not be distracted by the arising and passing away of feelings and thoughts. Notice the arising and the passing away of your breath in your body. When you find that you're caught up in your thinking, simply acknowledge the distraction and return mindfulness to your breathing. Relaxing your thoughts, remaining mindful of the arising and the passing away of your breath in your body. And we will continue to meditate for 30 minutes with callbacks every 5 minutes. noticing the arising and the passing away of feelings and thoughts, while remaining mindful of the arising and the passing away of your breath and your body. relaxing thoughts, remaining mindful of your breathing. noticing the arising and passing away of feelings and thoughts, while remaining mindful of the arising and the passing away of your breath in your body. relaxing thoughts, remaining mindful of your breathing. Noticing the arising and the passing away of feelings and thoughts, while remaining mindful of the arising and the passing away of your breath and your body. And we'll continue to meditate for 5 more minutes. Take a moment to notice the quality of your mind. Be at peace with your mind. And when you're ready, you can gently open your eyes. Well, this morning we are at class 26 of 32 classes of our structured study of Vipassana, introspective insight into the three marks of existence. So we started by establishing the broad context of the Buddha's Dhamma, dependent origination, Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. And in each class, we've been developing an ever deeper understanding of where Dhamma practice resides within each and every individual Dhamma practitioner. And we kind of concluded that focus with the Jhana Sutta a week ago that really put the fine point on the Dhamma is practiced at the point of contact within each and every individual. And the techniques that we use to develop that type of refined mindfulness and concentration. And so beginning with Tuesday's sutta, the Sambodhi Sutta, the Sutta on the Wings to Self-Awakening, and continuing with today's sutta, we're engaging with suttas that describe more of what practice, what Dhamma practice feels like and what it looks like, what we're actually developing, the type of right view that can then supplant wrong view and establish itself. Why? Because it's based in reality. And so this sutta is called the Jiramananda Sutta. It's a sutta to Jiramananda about what understandings, 10 understandings that he will develop as an aspect or as a culminating aspect of his Dhamma practice. Okay, let me start. It'll become more clear as I read this. On one occasion, the Buddha was staying in Savatthi, in Jita's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. Venerable Giramananda was sick and distressed. Using the word venerable is important there, not just to show respect to Giramananda, but so we understand that he is a long-term and accomplished Dhamma practitioner within the Buddha's original Sangha. He's someone that has a very thorough understanding, but is possibly missing just his view of what he's looking at. Similar to what we talked about earlier, about how to look at words that we might find distressing or off-putting, put them in the context of the Dhamma. Venerable Giramananda was sick and distressed. Ananda went to the Buddha and asked if he could visit, I have wood there, it's a misprint, if he would visit Giramananda out of sympathy for him. The Buddha replied, Ananda, if you would go to Giramananda and tell him of the 10 understandings, it is possible that upon hearing your words, his distress will be relieved. Really what he's asking Ananda to do is to go to Giramananda and point out to him what he's developed within his own Dhamma practice. If he's holding up these 10 understandings so Giramananda can see them and know for himself that he has done this. And so this is a good description too of the difference between our initial intellectual abstract view of what the Dhamma is, simply hearing the words, and then the actual application of developing the Dhamma. And that's quite different. They have the experience of what was once an abstract idea. It's even an abstract idea that I can maintain a calm and peaceful mind no matter what, isn't it? Until we actually do it. And then it's no longer just an abstract idea. It's who we are. And that, so again, Ananda's pointing out to Jiramananda, this is what you're doing. Take a look at it. I'm going to skip over some of my commentary if you've read this. These are the 10 understandings you should teach Jiramananda. One, and the Buddha starts out with the overarching theme of his Dhamma, which is the self in relation to all impermanent phenomena. And so the first understanding is the importance of understanding of impermanence. The Buddha says, this Dhamma practitioner, well secluded while establishing jhana, knows that the five clinging aggregates, the form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing thinking, meaning the personal experience of suffering rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, are all impermanent. In other words, this thing that I've created myself, the self that I've created, is itself impermanent. And that's the first and last understanding. And in many suttas, the Buddha, we've come across this line, that if it's impermanent, how could it be a self? As we develop this understanding that all these fabricated views and fabricated associations with those views are rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths and are impermanent. It's such an important point. It's not enough to just understand that my views are rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, because unless I understand the impermanence of them, I will continue to grasp and cling to them and maintain them. And that manifests in all very, very subtle ways that takes a well-concentrated mind in order to see it. Because many of the strategies that we've employed to hold on to views seem entirely reasonable to a mind rooted in fabrications, hence the need for an Eightfold Path to recognize that. Again, it's what you brought up earlier today. This is called, when we do that, when we can understand the impermanence of all things, including this thing, this personal experience of suffering, is called understanding impermanence. That's the Buddha's words. Again, so it's not, and I get this question often from, or a comment from new students, especially students online, that right immediately when they see the focus is on impermanence, the response is, well, I understand impermanence. Of course, everybody does. But we do in a fabricated way. In other words, we don't apply impermanence to ourselves. We apply it to everything else but me. When the fact of the matter, it's not that important that we apply it to everything else. That's an understanding. What we have to apply is that these views I've created in myself are impermanent and fabricated views. Let go of that. Remember when Kandana first heard the Buddha's teachings on the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Buddha concluded that short sutta with Kandana now declaring the arising, what is it? I can't think of the, all fabricated things that arise are subject to cessation. In other words, Kandana got at a very powerful and subtle level the impermanence of all things, but most importantly, his own conditioned thoughts. And so that's the type of understanding that this sutta is pointing to, and that the Buddha is telling Ananda to remind Jiramananda that he's developing. Let me pass over again some commentary. Number two, the understanding of not self, following it, and again, notice the sequencing. Following an understanding of impermanence, we can understand not self. The understanding of not self, this Dhamma practitioner, while secluded, while establishing jhana, does not self-identify with what is seen or what is heard or what is smelled or what is touched or what is tasted or what is thought. Remember the Bahiya Sutta. They have developed... They have developed restraint at the sixth sense base. We've talked over and over again about where is Dhamma practice? In the moment at the sixth sense base, as we are coming into contact with either the external world or coming in contact with our own fabricated views arising in this moment. But it is in this moment that we can practice a Dhamma. There is no Dhamma in the past, and there will be no Dhamma in the future. The Dhamma is only practiced in this present moment. It's only effective in this present moment. And that points back to the idea of intellectual abstractions about the Dhamma and the actual practice. So the intellectual abstractions that we develop by listening to this and other ways are then developed as we continue with our Dhamma practice. Is that true? Has all of you experienced it that way? Yes? Please answer, because if you're shaking your head, I can't see it. And so, again, the Dhamma is to be experienced. But in order for us to do anything, we have to first understand what we're doing. In order for me to get up and walk out of the room, however ungracefully as I do it now, I have to first have the thought and the understanding of how to do it. If I never develop the understanding, this would be my life, isn't it? So it's our thoughts that ultimately motivate and manifest our lives in this moment. If what we're holding in mind is framed by the Eightfold Path, we'll have an understanding of impermanence and not-self in this moment. Does everybody see the value in what the Buddha is telling Ananda to point out to Venerable Gyuramananda? Because we've all had to realize this for ourselves, that the Dhamma is actually bearing fruit. We talked about this last week, and almost every class that we have is, look at this. This is what it looks like. This is what it feels like. This is the experience of Dhamma practice. That's what this sutta is all about. Number three, the understanding of unattractiveness. This Dhamma practitioner, well secluded while establishing jhana, knows the entire body surrounded by skin and filled with decay and unclean things. They know there is this body of hair, nails, teeth, skin, muscle, tendons, bone, marrow, organs, feces, urine, phlegm, sweat, tears. Understanding this, they are always mindful of the unattractiveness of the body. This is understanding unattractiveness. Many people don't want to even face this. Even sincere practitioners will wonder, why is this even here? Why is the Buddha asking me to look at myself in just this manner? Why would an awakened human being ask us to look at the reality of what it means to have a human body? Anybody want to answer? Please.
Understanding of impermanence, because it doesn't last.
And where is impermanence experienced most immediately? In the body and in the mind. And so if we can understand at that profound level, this thing that I am so enamored with, this thing that's going to play center field for the Yankees one day, this thing that's going to get a Maserati next week, this thing that's going to get the greatest job and the greatest girl and the greatest this and the greatest that, is full of this. And it's not that I should be disgusted with myself, it's just that I should stop taking myself so seriously. Because there's nothing inherently attractive about any human being. No matter how you look against societal's view of how human beings should look, which is a very narrow view, there's no self there, isn't it? No matter, again, even if I'm in center field for the Yankees, it's just six properties playing center field for the Yankees. If I make more of it than that, I'm in trouble. It's just this. And if I understand it at that very basic level, looking within my own self and the difficulties, the inherent difficulties of having, again, notice, I mean, you hear me say this often, this is just the opposite of that pernicious view of we everything should be positive. We should always look at things positively. Well, that's a complete break from reality, isn't it? And the stronger we cling to that, the more psychotic we could become over thinking that way. And I've seen that personally. And that doesn't mean we should look at everything negative, but the Buddha starts out the First Noble Truth as describing the negativity inherent in having a human life. Why? So we learn to accept it. Because he also noticed that we want to gloss over everything that is difficult and only look at all that is wonderful in having a human life, rather than seeing it clearly. Because some moments are wonderful, some moments are awful. But no matter what, as an awakened, fully mature human being, none of it's going to affect the way that I think about myself in relation to the world. Now. Sorry, Rob.
I just got out of that we should understand that the attractiveness that we see is fabricated.
Yes.
And that, not just like the attractiveness of what we think of ourselves and the attractiveness of others as well, is completely fabricated.
Completely fabricated.
It's, you know, because you're just looking at objects. You're looking at this object here. And, you know, why would there be an attractiveness there? It's these are like strange goings on in the brain, and they're completely fabricated.
Yeah, and that's the right word, strange, because in other suttas, the translated word is we become estranged from these. In other words, these views that were so familiar to me that they became me, even though they're fabricated, when I awaken, when I understand the nature of what I've created, these views are now strange to me. We're talking a little bit about this too, about how to see this, because these views now no longer, when I think of myself as a young kid needing to play baseball for the Yankees, center field for the Yankees, I can look at that and see the fabricated object there. And it's just that. It has no resemblance to who I actually am, because I see the absurdity of the view. What an awakened human being sees, and what Rama is referring to, is a human being is simply just this. Whatever is occurring in this moment is a human experience, no matter what it is. So I can have a human experience in this moment and not be aware of it. How? How could I have a human experience but not be aware of it? Because my view of what's occurring is fabricated. And so there's no awareness, because I'm seeing what's occurring in this moment from that fabricated view, that it obscures what's actually occurring, even though what's actually occurring is actually occurring. Are you following me? It's only my view that interprets and determines my experience of anything, including what's occurring externally, but also what's occurring internally, including possibly a reaction to a word that I'm reading. It's all part of this fabricated view. But when I understand in a broad and completely applied understanding of impermanence and not-self, then in this moment, I'm not taking anything personal. I'm simply five properties mindfully engaged in a human life. A mind at peace. A mind happy at peace, meaning not a grasping after happiness. That inner poise that is developed through a well-concentrated mind and understanding how to see what's occurring in its own life. Okay, let me continue. This is understanding unattractiveness. This also relates, we're going to conclude this sutta with this series of talks with the Anapanasati Sutta, similar to the Satipatthana Sutta, where the Buddha includes in that what is often called the meditation on the charnel grounds, which some lineages actually make as the focus of their practice. And the Buddha never taught that we should meditate on the charnel grounds, and that particular reference is just to be mindful of just this, of the body's inherent unattractiveness. And then the Buddha goes even deeper into those suttas about what happens after death, and the body breaks up and it's picked at by animals and birds, etc. But it's all just to point out this thing that I insist is permanent is me is completely impermanent, and there's aspects of it that are very unattractive. Why be so enamored with it? Number four, the understanding of drawbacks. Remember when Ram was talking earlier in the three suttas on dukkha, where the each one of those suttas talks about the allure and the drawback of sensual indulgence. Well, that's what we do with our minds. And so there's an allure to establishing a permanent self in impermanence, and there's the drawback of it. And it's immediate, isn't it? And ultimately, that allure and drawback of sensual indulgence resolves within an individual and their fabricated views. This Dharma practitioner, well secluded while establishing jhana, reflects on the drawbacks of the body. They understand the various pains of the body, such as disease of the senses, disease of organs, disease of the mind, disease of the body, dis-ease from changing weather. Meaning, and that last is not just changing weather, it's any change in worldly events or in our situation. This is understanding drawbacks. And we should, again, this is a direct counter to the so-called spiritual philosophies of the Buddha's day that, again, would encourage only looking at the positive. This, again, this is just as pernicious during the Buddha's time as it is today. It's just as cruel 2,600 years ago as it is today, because it simply continues and deeply entrenches our own ignorance of what's really occurring, meaning impermanence and not-self. Number five, the understanding of abandoning, just as important as all of the rest, understanding what we're actually letting go of. This Dharma practitioner, well secluded, while establishing jhana, abandons all thoughts of sensuality, all thoughts of ill will, all thoughts of harmfulness, and all unskillful mental qualities. This is understanding abandoning. So Ananda's pointing out to Jiramananda, notice this, and if you still have any of these left, if you still find some ill will coming up occasionally, know that you're not quite there. And Jiramananda knows what to do. Continue with your Dharma practice. He's not missing anything. It just means that he has a little more work to do. And that's a teaching for all of us, isn't it? If we're wondering where we are in our Dharma practice and how far we're going, if we find that we're still stuck in any of those moral and ethical aspects of the Eightfold Path, we simply need a little bit more Dharma practice. That's all. It doesn't mean we're doing something wrong. It doesn't mean the Dhamma doesn't work. It doesn't mean that we're incapable of it. It simply means, and that's what Ananda's, again, teaching. Notice this. Notice that there's more to go, but also notice how far you've come. The understanding of dispassion. And this is an understanding that we can easily use as a benchmark because we can see it in ourselves. We can see what we're dispassionate about, the dispassion we've developed, and the things that are still causing us a reaction, the things that we're passionate about. Look at the world today, isn't it? We are so ideologically divided by the things that we are most passionate about. And it's causing great harm in the world today. I don't want to get into the the hows and whys of it, but just look at what's occurring. It's not that we got to find out who's wrong, which side is wrong, and which side is right. Everybody's wrong if you're stuck in that type of ignorance that creates this type of division between all types of people and ongoing hatred. It's really remarkable what's occurring. The understanding of dispassion. This Dharma practitioner, well secluded, while establishing jhana, understands this is peace. This is the exquisite stilling of fabrications. This is the relinquishment of all clinging. This is the cessation of craving. This is the full development of this passion, this complete unbinding. This is understanding this passion. So again, the Buddha is relating understanding to the direct experience of it. He's not just describing what dispassion is. He's not a dictionary for these words. He's describing the result of an initial intellectual abstraction and how it looks. Number seven, the understanding of cessation. This Dharma practitioner, well secluded while establishing jhana, understands this is peace. This is the exquisite stilling of fabrications. This is the relinquishment of all clinging. This is the cessation of craving. This is the full development of dispassion. This is complete unbinding.
This is the full development of cessation.
What did I say?
You said dispassion, which belonged to the previous section.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Thank you. This is the full development of cessation. Everybody have that? So the Buddha's teaching that these aren't abstract ideas. We don't take anything on faith. We follow directions and we have this direct experience. Over and over and over, the Buddha emphasized, look for and develop this particular experience. Over and over and over again, the Buddha's saying, don't take any of this on faith. Don't just believe me because I'm a good guy. Or don't believe me because everybody else believes me. Only believe it when you develop it yourself. Because the Buddha understood it's the only way that we can change our mind from being rooted in ignorance to having a direct experience of reality, by having a direct experience of reality. And it's my, it, It's an individual's reality that is the only reality that a human being can experience. Makes sense, doesn't it? But that's, again, that's, that directly contradicts the fabricated view of establishing myself in some speculative non-physical existence, whether it's in the perception of neither perception or non-perception, or next year when I'm center field for the Yankees. They're both fabricated views. Or tomorrow when I am recognized as the world's greatest meditation teacher. All fabricated views. Even if any of them are true. Even if I find myself playing center field for the Yankees while teaching meditation and center field for the Yankees, it's still a fabricated view for me to think of it. Because it's not what's occurring right now. And especially when I start attracting or attaching views to the most remarkable center fielder that teaches meditation while he's playing. I mean, look, I'm being ridiculous to show where a mind can go with its own fabricated views and keep piling things on and dragging this self through life, a fake and fabricated self. Do you see the disappointment, the dukkha that is prone to thinking that way? Because now this little boy who insisted that his life would only be valuable if he played center field for the Yankees, was the world's greatest meditation teacher, and let's throw in that red Maserati. And when those things don't occur, here's a 20-year-old and a 30-year-old and a 40-year-old and a 50-year-old getting more disgusted with himself and his own life because he's not achieving the life that he fabricated for himself. It's the essence of insanity, yeah. Isn't it? But yet we do that, don't we? Now I just want to make that point.
I do.
Yes.
Dave has the same question I had, so go ahead, Dave.
I know there's a skillful way to work your way into this, but at the moment when you're an 8-year-old boy wanting to be a center field for the New York Yankees, how does ambition work into that at that moment, knowing that you're not practice? You just had an ambition.
Yep. And so, you know how I mean, I think it's the most accurate description of awakening is full human maturity. At 8 years old, there's not much you can do about it.
Like Anthony, you really can't. At some point.
So we live in a. I didn't hear what you say because I was talking over you. But let me make the point. We don't start making decisions about what we're going to do with our lives as individuals until we're 18, 19, 20, etc. We reach young adulthood before most of us are even charged with having to make decisions. And usually, even at 18, they're pretty mundane, like where I might go to school, et cetera. But some of us are in the real world. But it's at that point. When we're 8 years old, there's not many decisions we're going to be making for ourselves. And so we're simply a product of the world we're living in and our immediate family, obviously. So at some point in our lives, we start making decisions and we start seeing things. And we might make a decision. We've had some young people come here. Most of them don't say, but Kate does. And so we decide, let me learn something about my life. At 8 years old, it's just not likely to happen unless you're fortunate enough to have either family that's focused on and has developed a Buddha's Dhamma and can kind of point you in that direction. Or maybe in a few years, you start getting a little bit of your own interest. I think I started looking at so-called spiritual matters, maybe at 12 or 13, but they didn't mean much to me. So does that answer your...
Yeah, it's just, so oftentimes you look back and bring up those silly examples, but they're legitimate that at that time, that was legitimate.
Oh, yeah, yes.
Whether you had the skills...
And there are some 10 and 12-year-olds that can be very ambitious, especially in sports.
Yes, I was using an extreme example. I mean, I talk about playing center field for the Yankees just as an example. I didn't hang on to that for years and years. I did think about it for a while, but I'm just using it to make a. I'm using an extreme example to make a point. The grand ambition that a young child might hang on to into adulthood that could affect their adulthood certainly happens. But at some point you come to the realization that that's just not going to happen, so you do something else. I mean, that's just a normal human life. The point that I'm making is living in an abstraction will always lead to a disappointment until you let go of the abstraction, whatever it is. But the ambition to play center field for the Yankees also had some positive benefits. I went out and I learned as best as I could to play baseball. and I enjoyed it. And so that there was a good motivation. The motivation to maybe be a brain surgeon when I'm older might guide my early focus towards getting into med school. Those are good practical things in the world. The problem is that we create these strategies of establishing a self that then becomes the self rather than just a practical view. Well, I'm just these six properties, and maybe these six properties will go be a doctor. You know, it's just the way that we're looking at it.
The difference might be in the clinging, right? Mm-hmm. Because at the point you don't realize you just don't have the physical skills to be a baseball player. If you move on from that, and you know you find something you can do well, then you're not clinging. But if you continue to cling on to this, you know, like a lot of people, you always see that stereotype of the jocks, you know, that they end up having really bad lives because they don't get the women anymore, and they become bald, and they have like a belly, and they can't deal with that very well. Like, I think it's in how you deal with the fact that you're not making your goals or your ambitions.
Move on from that. As a strategy of living in the world, certainly. You know, again, we're talking about developing right view from wrong view. So the things that we do in the world as unawakened human beings are just things that we do in the world. When you're 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, you know, you're starting to prepare for your life, and you're doing things that are in preparation for your life, but it's almost impossible to do those things and not be rooted in eye-making as you're doing them. An 8-year-old who was maybe miraculously awakened or maybe was naturally born that way would probably be doing the same things, but there would be no individual eye-making in that. You would just be doing it, just like we are. You know, you wouldn't, but again, it's doubtful that an 8-year-old or a 10-year-old would have that understanding yet. Boy, good point. Did I cover? Okay. This is completed. Okay, let me just skip over. Number 8, the understanding of distaste for every world. So that's not a misprint. Every world simply means the endless worlds that we create in our own mind. And we can even see this about in our some people in their relationships. In other words, some of us have this group of people that are friends, and that group of people that are friends, but those groups hardly ever interact. And it might just be the way it is. It might not be a practical reason. It is a practical reason. It's just what happened. Or even the different scenarios that we find ourselves in our own mind are all worlds that we create. And they can be worlds that only live in our minds for a split second, but that's what we're talking about. And even in that split second, a fabricated world that we're clinging to is simply that. It's a fabricated world that is a distraction and will lead us to further stress and suffering. Understanding of distaste for every world, and the Buddha describes this even more, a little bit more deeper as we go on. This Dharma practitioner, well secluded while establishing jhana, refrains from all worldly entanglement. So that's a reference to the seclusion we establish on our cushion during jhana meditation. We're now able to take it out into the world and remain secluded, free from entanglements in the world. Refrains from all worldly entanglements, attachments, compulsions, and conditioned thinking. This is understanding distaste for every world. We simply let go of that clinging and maintaining that continues stress and suffering. Number 9, the understanding of the undesirability of all fabrications. This Dharma practitioner, well secluded while establishing jhana, is horrified, humbled, and repulsed with fabrications. This is understanding fabrications. We become horrified, humbled, and repulsed with fabrications. How do you all feel about that line?
You know how I feel.
Do you still?
I understand what you were saying.
Does everybody understand that Buddha is using these extreme words to describe the immediacy of eye-making and how we should address it? Because we know, as Dharma practitioners, we know how debilitating maintaining self-referential views is. It's the whole point. As the Buddha describes that type of human life as being a death-like state. rooted in ignorance.
I don't think they're too strong. I think it's just, it's so serious and so, yeah. It's appropriate to use those words.
It is. And when you can use them without the reaction that a conditioned mind will attach to it, and I look back at some of the things that I've done, it is horrifying what I put myself through. But what we all do.
Yeah.
A mind rooted in fabrication is most brutal towards itself, simply because of that misunderstanding. This subtle but powerful misunderstanding of self in relation to the world it lives in, the three marks of existence. Do you see how this all is just resolving in this one single point of knowing who I am in relation to the world? It's not annihilation. In fact, it's just the opposite of annihilation. To use a little bit of flowery language, it's the blooming of a human being when you develop the Dhamma, because it's the first time that we're actually present for our life as our life unfolds. It really is incredible when you think of it that way, but that's the way it is. Mm-hmm. That's the Buddha's breakthrough of understanding. Remember in the Nagara Sutta, he used those words in this breakthrough of understanding, because he's describing for the first time in his young life, in his 35 years on this planet, this breakthrough of understanding allowed him to live his life. Remember where he came from. He had a life that any human being would grasp after and cling to if they could get it. No, it wasn't for him. He described that life as confining. In fact, he described it as a dusty, confining place, even though he was living in the palace. Because he wasn't living a life. The simple and direct techniques and the broad understanding we develop bring us a life of lasting peace and happiness and nothing more. And for some, that's the problem, because a self-referential ego self is never happy with just peace and happiness, isn't it? It needs more. It needs a little conflict every now and then. It needs something to grasp after constantly to keep it going. This is understanding fabrications. The Buddha continues with number 10, the understanding of mindfulness of in and out breathing. This Dhamma practitioner, well secluded, sits comfortably, legs folded, their body erect, setting mindfulness to the fore. Remaining mindful of the breath in the body, they breathe in. Remaining mindful of the breath in the body, they breathe out. While breathing with long breaths, they know they are breathing with long breaths. While breathing with short breaths, they know they are breathing with short breaths. The reason why that's important is there's a whole other, and in fact, actually a lot of the mindfulness movement is about manipulating your breath in different meditation practices and sessions, and that there's some value in being meditating on just manufacturing long breaths, and there's some value in just manufacturing short breaths. So think about that. I'm making a long breath now. This is my long breath meditation. Oh my God, was it long enough? No, I think it should be longer. Oh, wait a minute, this is my short breath day. Well, no, it's so... The Buddha never taught. He taught to be mindful of your breath in this way. If it's a long breath, it's a long breath. It's just that, it's just my breath. Because anything else is what? It's I making. Now I'm making a long breath. And it could go on and on and on. This long breath is longer than yesterday's breath. Or taking very short breaths, or having it fall into a rebirthing session on your own. I mean, I've seen rebirthing is coming back, and they're not even calling it that. I've seen some mindfulness, so-called mindfulness techniques, that are really falling back into that rebirthing of the 70s and 80s, and called mindfulness. Well, the Buddha taught mindfulness in one single, simple way, in meditation, and then to take that mindfulness and frame it by the Eightfold Path. That's the only meditation or mindfulness that the Buddha taught, not some broad general mindfulness, and certainly not to manipulate our breath in any way. When we come to meditation, however our breath is how we breathe. That's all. Tim, you look like you're going to jump out of your seat.
Okay.
You sure?
Yeah.
John, who's number 9? I feel like I missed... Maybe I tuned back for 9.
Undesirability of fabrications.
You want me to read it again?
I thought that was 8. Okay. I thought that was 8. No, I might just be wrong. No, I just...
That's the undesired...
I just heard the numbers wrong then. Yeah.
You're good?
Yeah.
Okay. Remaining mindful of the breath in the body they breathe in, remaining mindful of the breath in the body they breathe out. While breathing... let me skip over that. Breathe again. This Dharma practitioner trains themselves. I will breathe in and breathe out sensitive to the body. Now, the sensitive and sensuality are two different words, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And sensitive simply means mindful of the body, meaning not analytically mindful of each and every sensation, just simply mindful that I'm in a body. That's all it means. Again, many meditation techniques, so-called mindfulness techniques, will have you start doing body scans or breathing into pain and all that stuff. That's fine. That's different practices. In jhana practice, we do it for one reason, and it's not pain resolution. It's not any other type of resolution. It's to deepen concentration. It's so important to remember that, because it seems reasonable when we're in a body in pain that, well, let's use meditation as a tool for that, as escape. And if we do that, it might help with the pain, but you're not deepening your concentration. And some people will say, well, what if I'm distracted by the pain? Come back to your breath. I mean, that's my meditation, is a lot of that, coming back to the sensation of breathing. I don't enter meditation with thinking that I'm going to resolve the pain in my body. For one, I've had it long enough to know that 30 minutes is not going to do it. But it's simply not appropriate. If there is a technique, if the so-called breathing into different parts of your body was effective in relieving pain, that's great. But it's not jhana meditation. And it's important to see it that way. We'll breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to the body. This Dharma practitioner trains themselves to breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to joy, sensitive to pleasure, just meaning being mindful that these are part of me, and sensitive to mental processes. That's something that has become even more interesting to me as my own, having developed enough concentration and slowing my mind down enough, and I think probably many of you have done this, just observing the mental process is interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Having the perspective to just watch where my thoughts are going
and
in
feelings.
This moment. Pardon
and
me?
And feelings.
Yeah. It's now interesting, meaning that it's no longer distracting. I'm just seeing what's occurring. And it also allows me to hear what other people are saying rather than put my own spin on what they're saying. You know, this prejudgment that it's very hard to do of other people if we have a conditioned mind to not condition what other people are saying to us. In fact, I think it's impossible. This Dharma practitioner trains themselves to breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to the calming of mental processes, sensitive to the calming of our mind, meaning that we are actually mindfully aware of it. This Dharma practitioner trains themselves to breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to thoughts arising and passing away. This Dharma practitioner trains themselves to breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to satisfying the mind. Think about that. All the grasping after that we've done to satisfy ourselves, we now find ourselves with a well-concentrated mind that simply being uniting the mind and the body is satisfying. It's enough. And we take that off our cushion and maintain that. This Dharma practitioner trains themselves to breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to releasing the mind and fabricated views. This Dharma practitioner trains themselves to breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to impermanence, breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to dispassion, meaning mindful of it, breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to cessation, breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to relinquishment of all, my words, of all fabricated views. This is called mindfulness of in and out breathing. Ananda, go to Jiramananda and tell him of the 10 understandings. If Jiramananda develops these understandings, his disease may be relieved. Really should say disease there. Ananda, having learned these 10 understandings from the Buddha, went to Jiramananda. Jiramananda, hearing Ananda, was relieved. His disease abandoned. That's the end of the sutta. What the sutta's depiction is, again, Jiramananda was an accomplished Dharma practitioner, and he just was lacking the framework to see what he was still holding on to and to see his achievements clearly and frame accurately. this is such an important sutta on what our Dhamma practice should look like and what we're hoping to develop. It's useful in that way. Let's start with Mary. Mary, how are you? Mary?
Good morning, John. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Mary.
Good morning, Mary.
Morning.
Good morning.
How are you, Mary?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
There's a lot here. I read this, and I probably read it twice. I understand it all. And then, like in other parts, not other parts, but in other experiences with learning this, you know, you bump into your real life and the real world that you live in. And I guess I'm just stating a fact. And then you have all this, and then you have these other things that are going on in your life as well. Yeah. And depending, you know, I guess where I am on the path is sometimes that is, there is some conflict, not conflict, but the implementation of all of this and the people in your lives that you love and care for and how they intercede. I guess it's just part of the journey.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you. Yeah, and in our moment, my moment life, this is what it looks like. Thank you, Mary. Hello, Karen.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Thank you. I really enjoyed this today.
As opposed to other days? No, I'm just kidding.
It just seemed clearer to me, so which is helpful because sometimes I just feel overwhelmed by it all. But this one really felt like a very clear outline. It seemed practical to me. And being a Virgo, I need practicality.
Yeah, we all do.
So, yeah. So, thank you. That's really all I have to share. I look forward to listening to it again.
Yeah. Thank you, Karen. Good morning, Anthony.
Oh, good morning. I think I will sit in noble silence today.
Good to see you. Good morning, Lorna.
Good morning. I will sit in noble silence.
Oh. Good morning, Jen.
Noble silence for me.
Oh, it's left his space. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning.
Hey.
I don't think I can get away with that. it's, again, a good description of a deepening practice. This is where we start. This is the middle, and this is the end. And it's good to see that applied to somebody who's like in physical distress and gotten distracted by it. And Buddha just says, oh, no, then, you know, put him back on the path. And he did.
Yeah, and thank you. And the Buddha's not saying that he'll be physically healed. What he's saying is that bring this to Giramananda, and it will relieve his mind, the view that things should be different in this moment by seeing things through these 10 understandings.
Yeah, he'll be at ease in his disease.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when you're in that state where you're suffering or whatever, a disease state, maybe you would forget, you know, so this is like a good reminder.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think we all would relate to this, that when even if you have a cold, it feels like that's how you're going to feel for the rest of your life, even though you know, in a couple of days I'll feel better. But how you feel in the moment is how you feel, and that feels permanent. Morning, Lisa. Good to see you.
Good morning, John. Great to be here, and I feel the repetition of the ideas is really key for me. Being in a calm atmosphere where my mind is not distracted, doesn't seem like it's distracted. And being able to just absorb the ideas better.
Yeah.
And then just, I said, well, I'll repeat the repetition. Of just the suttas are all coming from different angles and all just aiming, you know, for the same basic thing.
Yeah.
But a calm mind through the practice has just been what I, you know, exactly what I need. I'm a Virgo too, so she said that.
Thank you, Lisa. Tim, I gotta hear what you got to say.
Yeah, after the questions that I asked earlier regarding the sutta through meditation, I have more of an understanding of it, and as I develop more understanding of dependent origination, I tend to see the flow. The mental fabrications as an aggregate directly responding to dependent origination creates that self, that I'm making. And yeah, it is a horrifying thing if that continues all the time.
Yeah, it is. And that's
every
the right
aspect of your life.
And so it's the right word, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Know, yeah.
But I also was very, I was asking the same question Anthony and David was asking in my mind when we went over one of the understandings. And the thing, because I have a 16-year-old and I see how they struggle with these unrealistic expectations. And I think, yeah, what you said is, I mean, they have to work through it.
Yeah.
And we could only maybe be guideposts. And this helps, I think, with my relationship with my daughter to let her know that, yeah, there will be disappointments. And to have realistic expectations as a term of ambition. And I think that's something that's, again, Buddha kind of talks about with extremes, right? You can have an unrealistic expectation is an extreme view and a wrong view.
It is.
So that's what the sutta brings, really brings a lot of our lives into context.
Yeah. So. And the Dhamma into this is the context of the Dhamma. You know, you can see it that way. So, thank you. I'm glad you had that understanding and you brought that up, because it is important, you know, to realize that we should be horrified at, I mean, you know, at what we're doing to ourselves. That's literally what it is. Thank you. Good morning, David.
Great job. I'm all set. Thanks.
Glad you're here. Andrew, is that you on the end?
Yes.
It's good to see you. How are you?
Silent.
You're here. Please say hello to Judy. Miss her. Hello, Kevin.
Good morning. This is, I think, they're really, well, they're all important suttas, but this one really is. It's just that it's sort of a corollary to the path and the other suttas. So I just want to thank you for bringing this to us and helping us on the path, and it really helps us see the path again and come back to it.
Thank you, Kevin. Yeah, and it's the right suit at the right time. It really fits in nicely right here in this sequence too. Mm-hmm. So. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning. Well, I like the aspect of this whole class of, if you don't quite get it now, keep at it, and hopefully you will get it eventually. Because sometimes I can really feel like a meathead with some of these concepts, but eventually they do penetrate. The other thing is, I would like to quote the venerable John Lennon, if I might.
Always good.
Yep, life is what happens while you're busy making other plans.
Yeah, he's right. He's right about a lot of things.
Yeah, that one sticks in my mind.
Thank you. Morning, Becky.
Good morning, John. Very good to be here. This sutta was very good. I felt like it just being in class is, you get reminded of very, very concretely of what it is that you're trying to do. Because like Mary said, you come up, you bump up against your real life, and it's a really big distraction from right view. And when you come to class and you listen to a pseudo like this and you listen to what other people said, you again are not just reminded intellectually, but you begin to feel again what it is you are working toward. And you get a little piece of that coming in. That experience actually happens while you're sitting here. And then you realize that if I could just maintain the concentration I need to keep this going, and the whole thing sort of comes together in a way that makes you realize what it is you're doing and why you take these steps to get there, because you can see it for a minute, just for an instant, and then it's very hard to keep your mind there. So thank you.
Thank you, Becky,
for these classes.
You're welcome, and thank you for your participation and the beautiful description of how this works. That's the important. The Sangha is the place that we can have the experience of the Dhamma over and over again in a supportive and welcoming atmosphere, whether it's online or here. And it is remarkable. Again, I've been around this Buddhist game for a long time, and I've never seen anything quite like this. It's developed this way, this well-focused, I don't even want to use the word devotion, but it works, to just the Dhamma. And again, this is what Becky described. This is how it works. This is what we experience in every class, is the Dhamma coming to life. That's why it's structured this way, and it works pretty well, doesn't it? So, thank you. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, John. I want to address this issue with this 8-year-old kid.
Oh. This poor kid.
If this 8-year-old kid who wants to be center fielder for the Mets.
No. No. It's a fabricated delusion. And it could be first base. It's all
understood. See now, if Buddhism was taught in school at an early age, okay, and if this was the way society was, and all these concepts were at least introduced to children at an early age, then they would start developing understanding from a different perspective, so that even if they had these aspirations to be this or that or whatever, they could be also be, it would be tempered with understanding reality as life occurs.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that's basically dealing with that, okay? The other thing I want to touch on is this sutta is, there's a lot going on there. And there's a tremendous pot of soup there, so to say, with everything in it for the most part, right? But everything, and you know, like we could just rack our brains trying to like go through this whole thing, and you know, and we could overthink it.
Yep.
Okay? We can overthink it, but the whole idea of this Dhamma, of the Buddhist Dhamma, or to me at least, or I should say, not to be self-referential in that, but to just kind of like give an understanding, okay? Where does it all lead to, okay? It all leads to one place, okay? Our deepening practice, our jhana, obviously the jhana, the concentration that we develop during jhana, and, you know, that concentration, my suit man, what's your name?
Becky,
sorry, I don't get anyone's name right.
That's okay.
Anyhow, what Becky had mentioned about the concentration, okay? That deepening concentration, you know, permeates our everyday existence as we get more adept at it and more comfortable with it, more devoted to it, okay? So this all, everything that we've done here so far, as I can see, and Julia and I talk about this stuff endlessly, and to the point that she just has to walk away from me. But I go chasing after her. So, we never get anything done in the house. So. Oh, I don't know. This all leads, everything we do here, okay? So that, and this is sort of a simplification of a magnitude of things together. But it all leads to the present moment that's right before us, that we're in, and the realities that we incur in this moment and each following moment from this one, and how we react to those point of contact realities or things that occur at the moment. And as long as we're developing the Eightfold Path, that Eightfold Path covers everything, how to deal with every situation in every reality in every moment. And once we integrate that and we bounce anything and everything off that Eightfold Path, in time it'll be internalized and it'll be second nature, or it'll be just an intuitive response to the environment and anything that might occur in it. So that's kind of where I feel that this everything is going, and this the course and the direction and my understanding of it.
That's you got the whole Dhamma. Can you teach next week's class?
I'm nowhere near actually a complete understanding. I'm just working towards this.
Yeah, but you see it clearly, and you see how it, I mean, that again, that's key to the Dhamma, seeing how it's done. It's just that way. It's just the practical experience of the Dhamma. So thank you. Good morning, Julia.
Good morning, John. This sutta was chock full of information. The one that impact me was the same one that impacted Tim, with the understanding, number 9, understanding of undesirability of fabrications. When he used those three words, it kind of gives you a strong feeling of how you're supposed to maintain your jhana practice, so that you don't fall off this path. Yep. So that you don't create the fabrications that will cause you to suffer, mm-hmm. or lose your way. Like, you could forget, If you get involved in the world and all its complications, again, you can lose your way again. Yep. And that one is very impactful, because it shows the great fear of losing your way again. Anyway. So that one is the one that really, had extreme meaning to me. I guess the strong words that he used impacted me,
Yeah, as intended.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, sometimes the Buddha decides he's going to hit us right between the eyes. And this is a good example. But he does it out of an incredible wisdom married with true compassion. Mm-hmm. Because he knows these are the points that we need to be most focused on. This particular sutta points to practice at the point of contact, doesn't it? Right here.
In this whole thing, number 9 is the central why we do this.
Yeah.
And number 10 is how.
Yeah. Yep. And the first two are the results, and understanding of impermanence and not-self. And then the rest of it doesn't flow, does it? It's the end of it. That then is the Buddha's description of the quality of an awakened mind, calm and at peace. David brought up an 8-year-old, and it's the right time frame. You'll remember the Rahula Vada Sutta. If you haven't, look it up, but I think I decide I'll teach that on Christmas Eve because it's such a perfect one. The Rahula Vada Sutta is a Buddha teaching his 7-year-old son, Rahula, the Dhamma, in a very simple and direct 7-year-old way, because he understood that even at 7, he saw the eye making, he caught Rahula in a lie, or a series of lies. People lie for eye making. And he sat him down and taught him this very brief and beautiful sutta, that basically taught him the danger of being a liar in the world or living in that fabrication. So you're going to have to come on Christmas Eve if you want to hear. But, I mean, again, that what do we do with 7-year-olds and 8-year-olds that are acting out? Present the Dhamma in a broad and general way that they can understand and let them grow up.
You know? I thought it was really interesting that he asked for the Buddha as if he needed that enlightened person to teach him the Dhamma, and he sent his attendant. And that the Dhamma can come from anywhere. It is what it is, and that the Buddha trusted Ananda to go to a venerable, was he original to the Sangha?
Yeah, I don't know.
But
there's no way.
I just thought that was a really important part of.
Yeah. He's getting it. Well, thank you. And the other part of that, the other side of that coin is, it's a great teaching for Ananda, isn't it? Mm-hmm. To go out and teach his friend. You know, so it could be, you know, this is my speculation, our speculation. It could have been just as much for Ananda's benefit as Dhiramananda's benefit. Yeah. You know? And it's, you know, this is never lost on me. The remarkable thing about these suttas and the translations and the words we use, still works. It's just as effective today as it was 26. And we understand it, don't we? So again, the timelessness of the Four Noble Truths. And the timelessness in reference to the way human beings think. That hasn't changed at all. And that's not a negative thing. The self-referential views that we manifest in externally hasn't changed at all in 2600 years. And so the solution is still there. It still works. Remarkable. Is that Karen and Mary still here? Okay. We are going to have a class. Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve is on Tuesday evenings, and we are going to have a class. It might just be me and Lorna, but we'll have a class here. I kind of like the idea. It's having a class on those nights. So. We will have class. I hope some of you can join us. I know many of you are very busy, but
regular time.
I think that's it. And all right, don't forget our Sangha dinner on December 12th at Bamboo House. If you're bringing a small group with you, or even a few people, just let me know, just so I know. But if you're Kara's already expecting around 20, so we're good. We'll finish with metta, as we always do. So again, take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com.
I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.